in a world of mindless movie cliches. One podcast fights back. Critics are calling it profound, epic, free. Prepare to revisit your video cassette memories of the 1980s and 90s. Behold, it's VHS Rewind.
We have a special guest on tonight, Eddie Deason. He is a veteran American actor known for his iconic roles in popular films. With his distinctive voice, unique mannerisms, and comedic timing, Eddie has become a beloved figure in the world of film and television. From his breakout role as Eugene in Grease to his portrayal as the hapless nerd Wesley in War Games, whether you know his signature voice from blockbuster films such as The Polar Express, or while flipping channels you hear him on an episode of The Transformers, or even the SpongeBob movie, Eddie's career is vast and continues to flourish since he was just working on a film the other day. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Eddie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's my pleasure. I wanted to give you a small correction, beautiful introduction. You have slightly one thing just inverted. I played, you said Wesley in War Games. I'm Malvin in War Games, Wesley in Midnight Madness. That's totally okay. Don't worry.
All right, I'm sorry. I love Midnight Madness, one of my favorite movies.
Thank you. We were just talking about it today with Stevie, my manager. I was just talking about it. No, you know what it was? I just did a cameo video for it. We just did a cameo video, and they were Midnight Madness fans. It was for a guy's 50th birthday, and I talked all about Midnight Madness to him. You know, we did it like 10 minutes ago. We just recorded the video.
You bring up Cameo. Cameo is a service, which I've used before, where you can reach out to celebrities that you enjoy, and they will very often make a custom video or a phone call or something like that. So you have a Cameo.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I have a Cameo account. Anybody that wants to order a Cameo video, just get into Eddie D's and push into Eddie D's, and I'll be glad to record anything you want. No nudity. I'm sorry, ladies, but no, it's anything. Like I say, happy birthday, happy bar mitzvah. I will do whatever you want to answer. Any questions about any films, any personal questions, I will answer. I love doing them. I mean, they're just a joy to do. And Stevie will hold the camera. Stevie's a great cameraman. He's actually a great cinematographer, but he'll record it and we'll just record the Cameo videos, and they're very fun.
You know, I think Cameo is great. I really do. And I'm on it now. It's actually cameo.com/Eddie Deason. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And yeah,
thank you, Mark.
It's so cool, man. I think it's a great way also that I think we think celebrities are, you know, constantly partying, the guy who's just at home, like doing podcasts. We think like, you're not regular people. You're not human beings. And it's like, well, you are. And it's like, you know what? You're going to record this like 5-minute thing and it's going to really make somebody's like year. I just think it's awesome.
Exactly. And we're not all partiers. Don't get that misconception. I mean, I had 4 beers before the podcast. I was with a naked woman, but never mind that. Let's leave that to the side.
There you go. We'll get into it. So I guess, you know, first and foremost, I have some questions. My co-host, Chris Hassler, could not make it. So he wanted me to ask you.
Chris, my love, tell him I said hi, please.
I absolutely will. He wanted to know if you could share any stories or memories about working with Robert Quarry or Ginger Lynn in Beverly
Bob
Hills.
Yes, I love Bob Quarry. What movie? What was a horror? Was that the Beverly Hills Vamp?
Yeah, Beverly Hills Vamp.
Bob Quarry, I loved him. He was a wonderful straight man. I absolutely love working with him. Is he okay or what? Has he passed away?
No. As far as I know, he's still alive.
The only reason I ask, Mark, is because when I did it, he was rather old. I mean, I want him to live to be 200. I love Bob Quarry. He was great.
I'm fact-checking.
Wonderful
right
straight
now.
Man, easy to work with, nice man in real life, funny sense of humor, just a joy to work with. I'd work with him anytime. And Ginger Lynn, was she the porno girl? Did pornos?
Yes.
Okay, she was very nice, very sweet, a sweet girl. I could see where it's hard to transition from being a porno girl to trying to get into regular films.
Yeah.
So my heart goes out to her, but she couldn't have been nicer. She was totally, totally nice. Always a very sweet girl.
Now, Robert Quarry sadly did pass away in 2009.
Yeah, I figured because when we did that movie, he seemed like he was about 70. I mean, he seemed like a rather old man, and that was like about 30 years ago or something. So
yeah, he died about 85. So, Ginger Lynn is still alive.
Good.
God bless her. So yeah,
Still in the business? Is Ginger still working?
I don't think so. Is there really a market out there for? I'm 50, so I mean, is there a market out there for porn? people.
No, you're right. That's 30. Hard. And also the business is, let's just face it, it's harder on women than men. It's harder when a woman ages.
Yeah.
The business is crueler that way because women, you know, just in our society in general, they're more judged on their looks than men.
Yeah.
And when, you know, we all start losing our looks around 60 or that age. So yeah, sweet thing. I hope she had a happy career. I hope she's doing well now.
I think she's a huge icon. So yeah. I'm hoping that as well. I don't really know what the career of Ginger Lynn is, but I hope she's, you know, staying healthy and all that.
Yeah. I had never known about her, Mark. I'm not into porno films at all. I love women. I love looking at women,
sure.
But I never got into porno films per se. And I'd never heard of her. Then when we did it, I'd heard the story about her. So I just found out about her when we did the movie. I'd never heard of Ginger Lynn.
Yeah. And she's a screen legend. You know, she's one of those. So, you know.
Yeah, she's apparently a big star in that genre.
Now, for many people who might be listening to this, they might be your quote unquote friend on Facebook, or they might follow you on Facebook, and you post some amazing stories. I have to say this. I don't follow. One of the first things I do when I'm friends with somebody on Facebook and they start posting something that I kind of roll my eyes at, I'll start just unfollowing people. Mm-hmm. But yours, I don't see myself ever unfollowing.
You have
stories.
And, by the way, it's so funny you say that, Mark. I just before you called, I was cleaning house a little bit, so I dropped six people. I will take anybody on my page. Anybody's welcome. But the people that don't communicate, all those are the ones I drop. Not even if I look and they have a boring page, that's fine. You know, as long as they'll write me every once in a while, you know, make a comment. But these people, you know, the weird names, the ones that I see all now are in horror movies. There's some of the guys I accepted as friends. They're in these horror flicks and slasher stuff, bloody stuff. I don't like those people either. It's just not my thing. So I will drop those people. And, you know, so I hate to say, you know, just you can't keep everybody on your list, and I have to balance out with 5,000 friends, and people want to get onto my list, so I'll have to drop some.
And one of your friends I actually became friends with, and Alice McConry.
Well, she's the best. She's the best. I love her. I adore her. She's the funniest person on Facebook. She is so funny.
You and her have to have like a team. Like you guys have to go on stage and she'll come up with memes.
She's a dear friend of mine. Alice is a dear friend. She called me when I was in the hospital recently and we talked right after I got out. I talked to her. We're very, very close and I love her. Her page, it's the first page I go to in the morning. I do my own stuff. I'll put my post, you know, and I go to Alice's page first. She's the best. She's one of those rare people that really understands humor. She really understands what's funny. So many people don't. It's a gift, and Alice has it.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that you and her really complement each other as well. So you'll say something normal, and then she'll just come in with this huge comment, and it's like, what?
Yeah. Well, I take that as a great compliment. Compare me to Alice. Yeah, she's great.
So one of the things I wanted to bring up is one of the stories, and it was about how a dollar changed your life when you were 17 on the streets of New York City. And I live in New York. I grew up in, I'm on Long Island. So I really understand what you're talking about here. Would you mind telling that story? You can summarize
it. This happened, Mark, the summer of 74. I was 16 or 17 years old. I guess 17. My birthday's in March. I was 17. And I knew I wanted to be a comedian. I knew I wanted to be in showbiz. I was trying to get into the movies. So I had planned on going to New York. But because the only reason is because I'm Maryland. I lived in Maryland. And New York was closer than Hollywood. You know, New York is a short ride. Hollywood is 3,000 miles. Yeah. So I figure I'll go to New York after I graduate next year. I'm going to go to New York and try to make my way into movies. Anyway, we went to New York. And it was a joyous vacation. It was wonderful. I was with my family. I went to see the Marx Brothers film Animal Crackers was re-released.
Love it.
Yeah. I went to see it 4 days in a row, Mark. I loved it so much. We went to see Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway, you know, shopping, the great restaurants in New York, the hustle bustle of the streets. I was in heaven. You know, I fell in love with New York. And I resolved, I said, you know what? I'm not going to go to Hollywood. I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to make my career here. I'll go out next year when I leave high school and I'll go to New York instead. Then anyway, one day I went out. I wanted to go out for a walk. I said, I'm going to go out for a walk, take in the streets, just the exhilaration in New York. You know, you've been in New York City, right?
Yeah, I worked there for 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. Just walking the streets is magical. You know,
you're going to live there, right?
Yeah, it's just a heady experience. I was there at the 64 World's Fair we went, and that was the first time. I think I've been there one or two times before, but this is my first time, you know, at that age, 17. Anyway, I'm walking the streets. This guy's there. He goes, hey, man, you give me change for a dollar? I go, sure. He goes, give me a dollar. I go, sure. So I took out a dollar bill and gave it to him.
Yeah.
So I wait for a few seconds. I go, where's my change? He just looks straight ahead. I go, where's my change? I gave you a dollar bill. He goes, you didn't give me no dollar.
Oh.
He's looking at me straight on unsympathetically. You know, I started reeling. I realized, wait, it's starting to dawn on me. You know, I've been conned. This guy's a con man. He's a shyster. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. Obviously, the immediate thing is I want to, you know, fight the guy, take back the dog, give me it back, force. Mm-hmm. I must have weighed like 110 pounds. Yeah. This guy was a fully grown man, you know. So I was scared, you know, I first started to feel woozy. So anyway, I moved back from him and I made my way into the crowd, but I was woozy. All the glitter in New York wore off. I got back to my room. I resolved right then and there. I said, I'm not going. This city's a crap hole. All the magic in New York was gone because of that one incident for $1. I resolved. I said, I'm going to go to Hollywood instead. Mm-hmm. So I did go to Hollywood. Anyway, I go to Hollywood the next year after graduation. I got Grease, da-da-da-da. You know, that was my career. The magic started my career. Whatever magic I had started after I got Grease. Everything started rolling. You know, the ball started rolling.
Sure.
It never would happen. Now, let's go in retrospect. Let's say he'd been an honest guy, or let's say I never met the guy. Mm-hmm. But let's say he was an honest guy and he just gave me the change. I would have gone to New York next year. And the truth is, I probably would have been eaten up alive. The New York competition, you know, I could never have done Broadway. I'm not that good, you know. So it ended up for the best. I look at the story. It's kind of tragic in a way that I met a con man, because what happened is he took away some of my trust in mankind. You know, it's some of my trust in strangers. You know, I was kind of what's the word? It's like gleamy. There's a word for that.
Naive, like kind of, you know, green, green, yeah.
Like people, you know, now I take people with a grain of salt. They say, give me change for a dollar. I kind of take it, you know, kind of warily. Mm-hmm. So he took that away. But he actually helped me get my career started. And I actually owe this guy a lot. I don't know. I was wondering whatever became of him. He might be dead now, or he might be an old man, you know, probably an old, decrepit old man. He probably was a con man for the rest of his life. And he probably is decrepit now, you know, in some home or some seedy old hotel.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fascinating story, because this is also a lot of people have a vision of New York City now. Mm-hmm. And even though, like, right now, today, it's not exactly great either. But 1974 is a tough New York.
Yeah, it was rather tough on the streets. Yeah, it was just so condensed. I know, because I come from Cumberland, a small city. Cumberland is like Mayberry. Mm. You know, we all knew each other. New York is, you know, if you walk streets, it's so condensed. It's always like, you know, Macy's at Christmas. Yeah. There's so many people on the street, thousands and thousands of people hustling around.
It's overwhelming. You know? It's exciting.
Yeah, it's overwhelming, but it's exciting. It was a good kind of exciting. Then when I met this guy and that experience happened, he took away that magic, that fun magic and the joy of it. He took it away from me.
Yeah, that's really crazy.
Yeah.
And like you said, you went to Hollywood. I mean, and you were able to actually get auditions in Hollywood. I mean, in New York, I don't know. It just seems like all the movies were tough. You know, like I'm thinking like Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver, Midnight Cowboy. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
Midnight Cowboy, perfect example. And Taxi Driver, perfect example. Yeah, they're the grittier, blacker side of New York, the bleaker side. Yeah. So it turned out good in the end, but that incident, you know, I think we all have like those pivotal things that change our whole lives. And that was mine. That changed, as far as my acting career, that changed my whole life. Other personal things changed my life, but that one, as far as other people in my career, that was the turning point. $1. A dollar freaking bill.
You know, you got out cheap, I think.
Yeah, maybe so.
Now, you mentioned the Marx Brothers before, mm-hmm. Animal Crackers being re-released. You don't remember what theater you saw it in? Was it like a big one like the Ziegfeld?
If memory serves, I could be wrong. I thought it was called Rialto Theater.
Okay. That does ring a bell.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's gone now.
Yeah.
So we're talking about movies. I'm a big Marx Brothers fan. I'm a big.
Oh, me too. I grew up loving them. They resolved me to become a comedian. The Marx Brothers so helped me to become a comedian. Watching them made me want to be a comedian.
How funny are they?
When I discovered them.
It's remarkable how funny and how. You can watch a Marx Brothers movie that's literally 85 years old.
Yeah.
Right now.
Like Shakespeare. It's like Shakespeare, Chaplin, you know, this stuff. It's mm-hmm. like Beatles music. This is great art and it'll always be there and it'll always be funny. Yeah. It's like in the same sense that Shakespeare always great and the Beatles music will always be great. The Marx Brothers, Chaplin, the Three Stooges, you know, they'll mm-hmm. always be great.
And also Marx Brothers music. It's phenomenal. You know, if you really take
Chico, you mean on the piano? Yeah, he's great. He's always wonderful. Chico was not the comedian. Groucho and Harpo were the stars. They were the brilliant comedian. Chico was lesser of a comedian, but if you watch him in some of those piano numbers, nobody could play piano like that guy. So he added that. Mm. Chico was a good straight man for Harpo. He was kind of a comedian with Groucho. But, you know, his character wasn't as clever. Groucho and Harpo had these, inimitable characters. Nothing's ever been done before since like them. Chico just had this stock Italian guy. He was like this Italian character. Yeah. It kind of looks kind of backwards nowadays. You know, the PC era we live in, it kind of looks like backwards.
It is.
I was looking at some of his piano stuff the other day, and this guy's piano playing with the fingers shooting the fingers, you know?
The apple.
He's unbelievable.
Yeah. I always thought of the Marx Brothers as like the different like they represented different times of theater. So you have like the vaudevillian Groucho, then you have the silent era in you hear my Long Island accent right there. The silent era with Harpo.
That's and true.
Then you have like the more, you know, the early, you know, comedy of Chico. And then you have even Gummo. Let's throw Gummo in there, you know, as a modern, you know.
You know, the funny thing is Gummo was, of course, the least funny. Everybody agrees on that. But the films with Gummo were the funniest ones. They were the best ones. The five they did at Paramount were the magical Marx Brothers.
I love
when
Gummo.
They lost Gummo and went to MGM, they focused more on the music, you know, because Irving Thalberg, the producer, he said, women aren't going to see your films. You know, guys love the all slapstick, but a woman wants to see, women want to see the romance. They want to see some kind of a romantic story, and they don't want to see slapstick for an hour and a half. Yeah. So they changed them. You know, they took Zeppo out. They put in the musical numbers more, and, you know, the Marx Brothers changed. Night at the Opera and Day at the Race are still great. And then after that, the decline started to set in. You know, the last six are mixy. You know, the Marx Brothers are always great, but the last six are mixy. The first seven are the Marx Brothers magic.
Yeah, they get crazy. Yeah, I love them all, but I think it's like Star Wars with me. I accept it all. You know, it's,
yeah, totally agree. I couldn't agree with you more.
Love or hate.
Stevie and I were just watching. We watched about 2 weeks ago. We watched Night at Casablanca. And I just loved it. I loved it from beginning to end. I still love it.
I haven't seen that one in a very long time. But
yeah, still funny.
And what other movies did you watch growing up? Like, were you always kind of looking backwards as to, like, you know, old Hollywood?
Always. To this day, I'm a reactionary with comedy, and definitely a reactionary with music. Always with music, always the six. I like the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. After that, my musical taste is pretty dead, but I love the Beatles. Film wise, now I do like some contemporary films. I like, you know, recently made films, some, but my favorites are all the old ones, you know. Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, I love. Mm-hmm. Chaplin, I love. Buster Keaton, I love. The Marx Brothers, of course, I loved. You know, there's, I like, do you know Wheeler and Woolsey?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I love their films. I think they belong in the pantheon with the great comedians. Now, they're kind of forgotten today, now that, you know, compared to Chaplin and the Marx Brothers.
Yeah.
Most people are at least aware of them. But Wheeler and Woolsey, a lot of people don't know who they are. They're, to me, they belong in the pantheon of the great comedians. They always made me laugh. I love all their movies. Yeah, I thought they were great.
No, they're pre-code, which is why I think a lot of their stuff doesn't really make it. And their career kind of suffered after the code.
Right. Gotcha. Okay.
That's the way I always looked at them. But they were huge. They were as big as Marx Brothers.
You know Wheeler and Woolsey, you know a lot about them. Then you know. Yeah. Yeah. In their day, they were as big as the Marx Brothers. They were gigantic. Yeah.
But it's crazy that they're barely a blip now.
You have to be a real connoisseur to know them. I used to go to this obscure video store called Eddie Brandt's in Hollywood, and I'd rent out all the Wheeler and Woolsey. That's how I discovered them, and I loved every single one. I loved them all. I think, sadly, Woolsey died. He died of some kind of illness. He died, like, in his 30s or something.
You know, I don't know too much about
They were going great guns. They were moving along, and then the one guy had a bad – Burt Wheeler, in fact, his birthday is today. He was the handsome guy, and then the funny guy with the glasses was Woolsey. He had – Google him. He had some kind of tragic disease. He died, like, about age 40, and it just kind of ended it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, their careers just taking this weird downward spiral really affected them. As a team and separately, but you can still find their stuff out there. The pre-code stuff is really, really interesting, you know?
Yeah, I love their stuff. Abbott and Costello, I liked this kid. They've kind of worn thin on me. Abbott and Costello was the one I was wowed about when I was a young kid. They were my favorites. But then now they seem very dated to me. I'll look and it's like the pun stuff just gets dated with me. I could see Bud Abbott was a great straight man and Lou Costello was a great comedian. But for some reason, my affinity for him has just gone down over the years. Laurel and Hardy, I always loved.
Oh,
I never got tired of them. They're wonderful.
Yeah, Abbott and Costello to me were a little bit bubblegum Hollywood, a little softer. And it's great. Yeah. It's funny.
I don't know. I just think more than any other, they're in the pantheon of the greats. I think more than any other greats, they've dated. They've aged badly. Whereas I think Chaplin still is fresh today.
I love
Chaplin. You can still look at some of his films and they're fresh. Buster Keaton's still fresh. And they were long before Abbott and Costello. Mm-hmm. But Abbott and Costello, watching a film now, it looks very dated.
Yeah, I could watch a Chaplin stuff that's well over 100 years old. And I'm cracking up. I'm loving it.
The guy was the greatest. He was the king of them all. I mean, you have to face it. He was the best of them all. He was the king. And it's Chaplin first and everybody else.
Now, you mentioned you're a big Beatles fan, but I think that you're understating your love of the Beatles.
I'm a Beatles maniac. I touch Paul.
What? This is one of my questions. I wanted to know if you had met any of the Beatles.
Yes, I was doing the show Punky Brewster and George Gaines on the show. I don't know if you ever saw that show, but George Gaines was the father on the show. George Gaines is like a distinguished actor, but he was on that show. And he got me tickets to the Tonight Show, the Johnny Carson show. He knew I was a Beatles fan, and out of a kind gesture, he got me tickets for the Paul McCartney show. So I'm there at the show, and of course, Paul's there. You know, I'm going crazy.
Oh my God, Paul!
Then after the show, okay, a bunch of us ran out. It was like a Hard Day's Night. A crowd of like 100 or 200 of us ran out. Paul, we see Paul's cars coming out. We all went out to see him. Paul, you know, so experienced because he knew how to handle it. He rolled down his window. He was there. I touched him on the shoulder. I touched him on the arm.
Oh, man.
Okay? So I touched the Beatle. I touched Paul.
That's awesome.
Then here's the weird part. Now, I remember the next moment, I felt like the weight of an elephant hitting my foot. It was a crushing thing. I think it was too heavy to have been a human being. I think his car drove over my foot. It was a little sports car. It was like a little mini. I think he drove fast. He kind of peeled off to get away from us, and he peeled over my – I think he rode over my foot. Now, if it wasn't, it was some fat guy or some fat woman, but somebody like an elephant just crushed my foot. So to this day, I'm not sure what, but I think Paul McCartney drove over my foot too. So but I did touch it for sure.
Paul McCartney hit you with his car.
Paul was interviewed by a friend of mine named Joe Pope. Joe Pope used to do a Beatles magazine called Strawberry Fields Forever. Sadly, Joe died of AIDS years ago. He was a great guy. But anyway, he interviewed Paul in the magazine, and he asked Paul if he'd ever seen a film I'm on called I Want to Hold Your Hand. That was the Beatles movie I did about going to see the Beatles. And Paul did an impression of me. He goes, and the answer come back. And the answer come back. And the answer. And he said, Paul did an impression of me. So Paul McCartney did me. And I also got to touch Paul.
I think that's huge. Yeah, you know,
it was one of the most flattering things to hear. Touching a Beatle, of course, was a great, you know, great goal. Paul McCartney, if you think about it, he's brought more joy to the world. This is what I always say about him, and nobody's thought of it. Paul McCartney brought more joy and happiness to the world than any other human being in human history. If you think about it, no religious figure, no political figure, no sports figure, mm-hmm. no entertainer has ever brought as much happiness to the world as Paul McCartney. And he's been doing it for 60 years. You figure that I defy anybody to dispute that statement. Not Jesus. And Jesus brought a lot of joy. But sadly, Jesus brought a lot of war and unhappiness to the world, you know. Mm-hmm. But he was a great man. Buddha. But I think Paul McCartney has brought more happiness to the world than anybody, than any human being that's ever lived.
And he's still doing it. He's still 80 years old.
He still has a great voice, still a great guy. You know, John had like this, John I love, John was my favorite, but John had this mean streak in him. He had a mean side to him, a gnarly side mm-hmm. with the great side, with the beautiful side. Paul's pretty much just a great guy. He just is, just a great guy. Anyway, I saw Ringo in concert. He was the first Beatle I ever actually saw. My dad got me tickets. We were in Atlantic City, and I saw Ringo play with the All-Stars. That was fun. And then my George story was I was playing Santa Claus. It was always been one of my dreams, Mark, to play Santa Claus, always on my bucket list. So I was at the Beverly Center. It was Christmas of 79, and I'm sitting there with my friends. We were smoking cigars there over Christmas, you know. In those days, you could smoke indoors. So I swear to God, this lady comes up. She goes, could any of you guys play Santa Claus? Our regular Santa didn't show up tonight. So I about jumped through my skin. You know, this is my dream. I got in. They put me in a Santa Claus suit with a big pillow. You know, I weigh about 140 pounds.
Yeah, you're not a big guy.
Yeah, they put a big pillow in me. And, you know, I played Santa Claus there. So I was taking my break. By the way, what I realized about playing Santa Claus, Mark, here's the thing I realized. Excuse me. Let me just sip of water real quick. Excuse me.
Yeah.
What I realized about Santa Claus, and this is what you realize if you play him, is how many kids are terrified of him. I would say about 25 to 50% of the kids were brought up, and these kids were scared to death of me. I tried to be friendly, and they were just scared blankless, you know, to see Santa Claus. What I think is the beard, maybe the beard scared them. I don't know, because I tried to be friendly, but they were terrified. Anyway, I played him, and then I took my break after playing Santa Claus for like a half hour or 45 minutes, and I'm hanging out. You know, I looked like an idiot. I had Santa's pants on, no pillow, and I had just my white T-shirt on. So I have Santa's pants and black boots on and a white T-shirt on, and I had my beard off. So I'm walking around. I look at the bookstore. Who's coming out but George Harrison? George Harrison comes out. He has a bodyguard on each side. He had bought a book. I never found out what the book is, but George had bought some kind of a book. He's carrying a package, a little bag with his book in it, and he's there. So anyway, nobody noticed him. Nobody talked to him the whole way. George Harrison walked all the way down the corridor of the Beverly Center, and I was there. I hopped alongside him. I did. I was too scared to say anything. Looking back, I should have said hi, George, or something, but I was too overwhelmed by the moment to say anything. Yeah. So I hopped down parallel to George. I was like just a few feet away, and I hopped down parallel. The bodyguards were on, and I hopped away, and he went out the door, you know. And I regret to this day I didn't say hi to him. He seems like a pretty cool guy. I think he would have just said hi.
He probably would have waved to you at the very least.
Yeah, just acknowledge me. Yeah, I could see he didn't want to be bothered. Whereas Paul McCartney is very open. You can see Paul loves people and he's really out there. He's open. George always had that introverted flow. He was like, Paul's flow is outward. George's flow is like inward. Leave me alone. You know, I want to meditate. I want to be with Maharishi, you know.
Yeah.
So I think he was that way, but I could have just said hi. And I think he would have just at least nodded.
Do you follow any of the meditation that the Beatles do, the TM?
I've never actually done it. I don't know, but I think Ringo does it to this day. I think he medicates to this day.
I've practiced it for over 20 years, actually.
Okay, did it help you?
Yeah, I think. Okay. Well, so far, it's only been 22 years.
So. As far as religion, I'm so open. I'm so open-minded. There's so many different religions. And obviously, we're all going through our own issues. We're all going through our own junk, you know. So whatever works, you know, absolutely. With John Lennon, whatever gets you through the night, whatever works for you. I hold nothing against people, as long as you don't hurt anybody else, but whatever works.
You have so many stories. Have you considered writing them down and publishing them?
I would love to. You know what it would have to be? It would have to be like you, Mark. It would have to be a good writer, and he'd just have to do an interview like this. I think I couldn't take time to write them all out on the internet. It would just take too long, because I have probably like hundreds and hundreds of stories after all this time. But it'd have to be a good interview. Like, did you ever read the book by Dick Cavett? It's called Cavett.
No.
It was written by a guy called Christopher Porterfield, and he just interviewed. It was like a great Playboy interview, and they just interviewed him for like 200 pages, and he answered the questions.
That's how Chaplin's book was written.
He's a great writer that would be willing to do that. Then it would be a really good book. Because I see a lot of these guys of my ilk, you know, we're not the A-list. We're like B-list guys, you know, B-list movie guys, B-list TV guys have written books. So I would like to do a book like that. Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, you know, Johnny Cash as well as Charlie Chaplin both did their books that way.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to do. Now, Chaplin, he wrote his, though. He wrote his autobiography.
Maybe I'm thinking of a different one.
I don't know. But Chaplin is – my autobiography, it's like 400 pages. I enjoyed the read. A lot of critics didn't like it because he left out a lot of stuff. But with Chaplin, you know, if he wrote everything, it would take like 1,000 pages. You know, it would just be too long.
That's true. And you have to go back and correct everything and edit.
What
about television when you were growing up? Like what was on the television –
I love my favorite was always Gilligan's Island was my favorite show. I had a huge crush on Barbara Eden. I didn't like the show I Dream a Genie per se, but I had a crush on Barbara Eden, so I would like that. I would watch the show just to see her. Gilligan's Island, I remember I had a huge crush on Don Wells' Marianne. And I think this was like, you know, the 60s. I think it was like 10 cents you sent in and got an autographed picture. It was a fake autograph, but I got a glossy picture. I think it was 10 cents. You'd send in a dime, literally. So it might have been a dollar. But I sent in, I got it. She sent me back a picture, and I treasured that picture as a kid. It was a beautiful picture. She was so beautiful, you know, when she was young. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I liked those. I loved them. Let's see, what else did I watch?
So comedy has been a really big part of your entire life from the very early days.
Yes. Huh. Unequivocally. I like the show. Here's a weird story. And this isn't PC at all. So you can take this out if you want. But a show I love was Amos and Andy. You can never show it nowadays, but it was a hilarious show. It would look degrading now to African Americans, but it was a very funny show. And I used to watch that religiously when I was a kid.
Yeah, I watched it.
Yeah. Wasn't it funny? I thought it was a funny show.
Yeah, I mean, I would watch that and the early Hal Roach stuff as a little kid.
Oh, yeah. Hal Roach is brilliant.
But even as a child, I understood what was wrong and degrading to people, but still funny for the time.
How old are you?
I'm 50.
Okay, you were more aware than me. I watched like the Three Stooges had the, you know, the black guy, the black maids and the black butlers, you know, and I just thought they were funny guys. The one where the plumbing, when the Three Stooges pick the plumbing and they have that black guy that works there, the African-American.
Yeah.
I thought he was hilarious. I thought he was like the fourth Stooge. He was so funny. He actually steals that short. He's the funniest one in it.
But, you know, growing up in New York.
He was, and you can look at it as degrading. It was kind of demeaning for an African-American. But if you look at that, the Three Stooges were stupid in that sense. You know, they were idiots. So. Yeah. You know,
but growing up in New York, of course, you know, I had a melting pot of every race and every.
Yeah, that's the difference between us, Mark. I grew up with was pretty much all white. I don't think I went to school with an African American until I was in junior high.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with not understanding.
Public school was all white. Mm-hmm. I remember asking a friend. I said, "Do black people go here?" And he goes, "I don't think they're allowed." That was his answer. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there was a local law, they couldn't be there. I don't know what it was. I don't know. When did Lyndon Johnson started it allowing, you know, segregating the schools? I don't know, but it was definitely all white.
So looking back at your career, when was the first time you were recognized on the street? Like you're walking down, it's like, wait, are you that guy?
This was before the movies. I worked at the Comedy Store and this guy's name, I swear to God, I remember, it's funny he asked me, his name was Cola. C-O-L-A. I've never heard that name before. His name was Cola. Yeah. And I was in the post office. My dad would send me a money order, literally to support me. He sent me a $400 a month money order. $400 a month, and that would support me in those days. This is 1975. And I'd worked at the Comedy Store. I'd done some stand-up. And I was in the post office, and he goes, "Hey, you're the guy from the Comedy Store." And I shook his hand. He goes, "My name's Cola." And I remember to this day, I was flattered. This was before I even did Grease or any movie.
That's awesome. I mean, it's got to be a great feeling, right?
Yeah, very cool. That's why we all get it. You know, that's the name of the game. We all want admiration, you know, whether we admit it or not. I think everybody wants it in life. We're all looking for admiration. You know, men want it from women. Women want it from men. We all want it from our friends. You know, the guys in the bowling league, we all want that particle called admiration. And I think us in showbiz just want it more than we want it from like the whole country, from the whole world, or from thousands or millions of people.
So,
but everybody wants admiration, whether they admit it or not.
No. Our podcast, VHS Rewind, years ago, Chris and I, we were watching movies and we started noticing this actor popping up in every single movie that we were well aware of. And his name's Eddie Deason.
Okay.
So we're like, all right, we love this guy. Like every movie we see, let's bring him up on IMDb and start going down the list. Let's pick some movies. And we're like, let's do a Deason Palooza. All right. We never did Grease. And I was talking to Steven.
No kidding.
And Steven said that you're like, well, why didn't you ever do Grease? But I think we're going to do Grease in the future. So.
Okay, yeah. Grease is one of my smallest, if not my smallest speaking role. Mm-hmm. I have like two lines, I think. First of all, the T-Birds come and mess me up. And then I say something to myself. I go, I got astigmatism. And then later, my big scene is I throw the pie and Barry Pearl hits me in the face with a pie. But he goes, what's your name? I go, it's Eugene. And he goes, you're a great pitcher. And I go, thank you.
It's so memorable.
I have four words, two lines. But because of the scope of Grease, Grease is known every country in the world. You know, Grease is a worldwide phenomenon. Grease is it's cataclysmic film. So
loved
that's not best known.
I'm known Grease in
Polar Express to a less end. Those are my big two. Polar Express, I'm known, people hear my voice and they'll know me from Polar Express because you don't see me in Polar Express. You see this cartoon of me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's weird. Like you look at you and you know exactly who you are, but also your voice is so identifiable. You can never do prank phone calls probably like me.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
You try to like disguise your voice. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I was also somebody who was friends with you on Facebook years ago, like in the old days.
Are we friends again?
I'm sorry?
Are we friends again?
Yeah, we're friends right now.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Okay.
Yeah.
You're an incredibly nice guy.
Thank you. Thanks. I really appreciate that. Chris is not so nice of a guy. I'm just kidding. But
okay.
One of the things is your uncle, who I don't think is your real uncle, I think is your friend.
Yeah, his name's Carl Bergmanson. We call it Uncle Leo is just a nickname.
Oh, yeah. So Uncle Leo, I reached out to him. This is a couple years ago, and I bought a couple autographs because I was like, mm-hmm. I got to get an Eddie Deason autograph when we were doing Deason Palooza. Mm-hmm. And I got one for Chris. I got one for myself. And at this time, your health was kind of declining.
Yeah, my heart went bad. The end of 2019.
And you went in for some surgery. And you came back. You came back on Facebook. Your posts were happening.
I was just talking to my doctor, and she said she was amazed how resilient I was. I told her all I'd been through. Believe me, I've been to hell. I don't have to be told about hell because I've been there. The last 2 years were pure hell.
Well,
before I had a blessed life, so it kind of evens out. I had 62 years of a totally blessed life.
Yeah, and I just think, I wanted to know if you could just address that just, in a minor way. You were very open with all of this. You came onto Facebook and you were like, look, these pain pills are really kicking my ass.
They're vicious. I wouldn't wish them on anybody. But the one that they put me on, one of the ones was called Xanax, and it made me, I hardly remember. I have a very good memory. I can remember being in the crib, first time I went to the bathroom, I can remember walking for the first time, all that stuff. I go back to being a baby. But the last 2 years, very, very vague because of that shit garbage,
Wow.
But anyway, this is what happened. The end of 2019, I started feeling very weird. I started feeling woozy, like getting vertigo. I didn't know what it was. It shook me up. There's a picture I have. I got to put on Facebook, but there's a picture of me. I was doing a signing show at the end of 2019 and I'm hugging this girl, but I'm like clutching to her.
Wow.
I was like trying to hold on. Cause I thought I was going to die. I really thought I felt so bad and so weird. I thought I was going to die. Anyway, they rushed me to emergency surgery at the beginning of 2020. I had open heart surgery. I got my heart surgery. Then I got an infection. An infection came into my heart and then I had a stroke. So it really looked bad. It really did look like I was going to die. They thought maybe I was going to die. And one lady, Alice Mulconry, you were talking about, she thinks I actually died on the operating table.
Wow.
But anyway, I couldn't eat. I couldn't get anything down, hard to eat. I couldn't sleep. That's why they put me on a lot of these heavy meds. And I couldn't walk. It took so much out of me, the operation, that I couldn't walk. So it was a long recovery process. And they put me, anyway, I'd gone through my whole adult life, no medicine whatsoever. I didn't believe in pills. I was like a Christian Scientist. I didn't even take aspirin, nothing.
Yeah.
Then they put me on a regimen of 20 pills daily, including this garbage Xanax and other psych meds, which I totally am against. but I had them, you know, and that really screwed me up. Anyway, I started doing weird things. I had some incidents in Cumberland. The big one was I was at a restaurant and they tried to ask me to leave from the restaurant. I don't know. I probably did something and I wouldn't leave. So the police were there. They started there and the police started chasing me around the restaurant. It's kind of funny if you look in retrospect. One of my friends at the hospital said, if you get that surveillance film from the restaurant, it's probably one of the funniest surveillance restaurant films ever.
They chased me around
the restaurant. I started throwing plates at him like a monkey.
Oh my God.
Literally. And I was taken in. I was arrested. And that was, you know, second degree assault, which in Maryland carries a 10 year jail sentence, you know. So I could have gone to jail for 10 years. Luckily, I had a good public defender. She got me off. I'm doing my probation. I'm on unsupervised probation for 18 months. I'm in a beautiful city called Spartanburg, South Carolina. Mm. Steve and his beautiful wife are taking care of me here. They're like my guardians, and they've been wonderful to me, and I'm totally happy. I'm totally over whatever happened, but it was a horrible experience. The hospital was worse than hell. It was the worst anguish you could imagine being there for 8 months. And before that, I served a month in jail. So it was just a horrible, horrible time in my life. Yeah. The hospital, the stuff I went through there is indescribable. It was a little less than a concentration camp, but it was almost that bad. The food was, you know, pig slop, dog food. It was cold. They had the air conditioning on 24/7 every day. And it was the middle of winter, you know, and you had like paper thin blankets. They were like sheets. I was cold. And I was there with hardened criminals. You know, these guys were, they told me they were selling drugs when they were 10. You know, these guys had been in prison for 12 years. So it was horrible. Very tough time.
Were you identified in there? Were they like, hey, you're that guy?
You know what happened? They didn't know me. And then we were watching TV and they turned on War Games. They watched War Games and everybody busted out laughing. They didn't know me. And I said, my scene's come in this movie. My scene's on. And they had my scene right. And everybody was just rolling on the floor laughing.
Did they think you were crazy? They're like, this guy thinks he's in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. One guy, my friend Ben, knew me. He said he thought I was an actor on location. He said he saw me come in. I said, did you know who I was? He said, I thought you were an actor filming on location. He thought that's why I was in the hospital. But most of these guys, you know, these guys are jailbirds. These guys are jailbirds and drug, you know, drug addicts and drug pushers.
Wow.
And they, you know, they don't know who I am. So they saw me and then they knew it. And then they found out who I was. And we became friends, you know, we'd play spades together. We'd watch TV together. You know, we had all our meals together. So we got to be friends.
Well, good. I mean, it sounds like you made the best of it. And you're also getting off the Xanax and any other.
Yeah, that was worst. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's great that you were able to clean everything up and move forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's pretty much the story of that.
Yeah, that's
the story. It'll be told. You know, there's a few more gruesome details, but that's basically it.
I was watching TV one day, and it's like your face is on TMZ.
Yeah, yeah, the TMZ thing. I didn't know about it until I got to the hospital. They take us to the library once a week. We go to the library for one, and I went there and I Googled Eddie Deason to see what's going on, and I saw the TMZ story, and I couldn't believe it. You know, so I went in, I talked to my doctor, Dr. Alex, and he was a good friend. He made me feel better. He got my morale, but that TMZ thing really depressed me. Believe it or not, the chutzpah, when I got out of the hospital, they asked my public defender if TMZ could, they asked if they could interview me again. Jeez. Those, you know, blankety blanks. That's a lot of chutzpah after what they did to me.
Yeah. I mean, outlets like that are really looking to get like the quote to get you to say the wrong thing. They're waiting for you to trip it up.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was a smart
decision. The worst side of us. And that was, you know, that was my worst moments they recorded.
But yeah, thank you so much for, you know, clearing that up or, you know, telling that whole situation. But while you're talking about bad experiences, I'm wondering, what about, like, looking back at your career, what about a bad experience on set? Like, you're working on a movie or a TV show. Is there
usually
like
a situation? They do almost always. I always put it this way. The biggest stars, all, you know, the Tom Hanks, the John Travolta, the Steven Spielberg, the John Belushi, always the biggest stars were always the nicest, sweetest people. Always. Everyone. It's always the lower grade, you know, these nobodies, the people I've never heard of, that gave me the trouble. And I said, some people gave me a little trouble. I remember Midnight Madness, although I really love the film and I love Michael J. Fox and I love Maggie Roswell. I love both directors. It was co-directors.
I love it.
Some of the cast members weren't that nice to me. They were little. And I remember the makeup man, his name was Marvin. He wasn't that nice of a guy. So that was my unhappiest experience, was filming Midnight Madness, even though I like the film. I think it's one of my better films. I think it's a funny movie.
Oh, I love Midnight. When I was a kid, I saw it. That was like an HBO type thing. Like if you stayed home from school, you'd watch, you know, Midnight Madness.
Yeah.
And that movie just blew me away because it also had Michael J. Fox in it.
Yeah, it's a very funny film. It's really a funny film. Stephen Furst is great. He kills in it. And it's just got a lot of funny stuff. Interestingly, Michael J. Fox is like straight-faced all through it. He's like nothing. And he went on to be the biggest star of us all. He was, you know, when we did it, that was his first film. He was total unknown.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
And then 5 years later, I was at Universal. I'd come out of an audition. I was walking around Universal. Mm-hmm. This red Ferrari spins in front of me and stops. I look and it's Michael. Says, hey, how you doing? And Michael, he was just the same sweet kid. Yeah. Totally, you know, he's the biggest star in the world. You know, this is after Back to the Future. Same sweet kid, not a big head at all, not conceited. We just talked in kibitz, and then he drove off.
I watched him on Curb Your Enthusiasm the other night, and it's probably already about 6 years old, but mm-hmm. he's really aged well, you know?
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah.
And that's he's interesting, with all his problems.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of, part of the joke of the episode is his Parkinson's, mm-hmm. and he seems as though he's able to laugh about it, and, you know, yeah, I think
good.
That's
good.
A good thing,
he's just
right?
a great, I can't tell you what a wonderful guy he is, and, you know, they're doing a Back to the Future 4, I heard, Stevie was telling me.
Really? I mean, they've been talking about
the
madness,
they have Zemeckis again, and they're doing computer graphics, CGI they're doing on it, to, you know, correct them, make it sound like Michael Moore, you know?
Maybe you can get in on some of that. You could be the dad.
I guess. Yeah, that's a can't miss. I mean, that's can't, you know, must see.
Yeah, that's incredible. So, you know, I don't want to steal your entire morning, but I just have a couple more questions.
I'm talking, yeah, I understand.
So a lot of actors who get typecast into a certain role tend to get really bitter about it. I mean, it's down the, you could probably just name like a lot of actors who are just like, oh, I don't like looking back in that. But you've embraced this character mm-hmm. that you've.
Yeah, it's pretty much me. I'd say the character's 90% me. This is how I really am. I'm really a goofy guy. I'm just a goofy, nerdy guy.
But have you ever struggled with that?
How I am. I can get serious, have a serious side if people want to be serious. But this is pretty much me. I think in the movies, I take my voice up an octave. I'll go, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, if you look at Polar Express, I take my voice up an octave when I play the character.
Yeah.
What are you guys doing? Hey, Santa Claus, I want all those presents. Hey, how are you, Bill? But I pretty much have this weird voice, and I'm just a goofy guy.
I love that. Yeah. But have you ever struggled with that? Have you ever thought, like, you want to try to do something serious or?
No, I really haven't. I'll be totally honest. I'm not that talented. I'm not that versatile. I'll say not talented, but versatile. I can't do a lot of things. I love to write. Like, I'm a good writer. I love to write jokes. I have the ability. I can just sit in my bed and the stuff I write on Facebook, it's pretty much all mine. I can just sit and go, okay, think of a joke. And I go, okay, I want to make a joke about Spielberg. And I write those jokes. So I have that ability. And I have the ability to do comedy. I love playing comedy. I love, you know, I'm slower at 66 now than I was at 20. Even I did, like, we did this experimental student film the other day, and I had to do a running scene, and it was hard for me to run. Whereas when I was 20, you know, I could run for miles, you know, my silly run. But this, I ran, you know, a couple yards, you know, and I was really tired. But I you know, I was better when I was younger physically, but I can still do comedy. I can still do my comedy voice, and I can still film. I got in front of the camera, and this is a low budget film. You know, it'll probably end up on YouTube or something, you know, some festival, an independent festival. But I filmed and I felt right in front of the camera, and I felt really good in front of the camera, and it felt so good. That's my natural habitat.
What is the name of that film? Do you happen to know?
This is the thing. Stevie thought of a title. It's going to be like a remake of Plan 9 from Outer Space, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, Stevie said they should call it Plan 9 and a Half from Outer Space, which is a funny title.
Sure.
Plan 9 and a Half, that's funny and clever. He said we're going to call it Plan 10, The New Story, which is a dumb title. That's a flat title. It's not funny at all.
Yeah.
It should be. And Stevie and I go, call it Plan 9 and a Half. It's funny, but this guy was obstinate, and it's his money, you know?
Yeah, doing 9 and a half would be kind of like a throwback to like Airplane or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a funny enough. Plan 10, you know, first of all, it's called Plan 10, The Next Story. People don't even know it's Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Sure.
So at least call it Plan 10 from Outer Space. That's semi-funny. But he's going to just call it Plan 10. People will miss the whole joke.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, that's definitely a questionable type of thing.
Yeah. I did one, you know, did you ever see Surf 2?
Yes, we actually reviewed Surf 2.
There was no Surf 1. That was the first movie in the history of movies where there was ostensibly a sequel where there was no original.
That's amazing. But
it was actually in the Guinness Book of World Records, the first film ever to be called 2 where there was no 1. That was 1984.
That's amazing.
And that's a funny film. But that's a film I'm proud of. I love that movie.
Yeah, we reviewed it. I think that it has really hilarious moments.
Yeah.
Thank you. One of the things that I learned through your Facebook is that you earned the 1 billionth dollar that the SAG gave out or paid out to its credit union.
Yeah. I'm used to getting residual checks, you know, as an actor, I've done lots of films. So I'm used to getting them and TV stuff, whatever. They give you residuals for everything. And I think it's perpetual.
And that's
so I
opened
one envelope and there's a letter in with it. It was $125. I think it was $125. I'm not positive of the amount. But I think if memory serves, it was $125, and it was definitely from Greece, that I'm sure of. But there's a letter. It said, congratulations, Eddie. This is the $1 billion in residual checks Screen Actors Guild has paid out since its opening in 1932, blah, blah, blah. And they invited me to this official ceremony. So I go to the ceremony. I got Patty Duke was our president those days. Patty Duke was the president of SAG in those days. And she was so nice. She was wonderful. And she introduced me to the press there. They took pictures. And, you know, I don't think they gave me an award even, but they just showed the check, I guess. I think I framed the check.
You got the dollar.
Yeah. I think I did spend the check. I don't think I framed it. Maybe I did.
Hey, it's $125. I mean, that's
yeah. It was probably worth, you know, a couple hundred dollars in those days. This is like almost, you know, 35 years ago.
That's awesome. So if I could squeeze in one more question before I let you get back to your world. What was your first car?
My first car?
Yeah.
Well, I can't drive, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that. Like, you said you don't
answer
drive.
The question. I lost this guy. Me and this guy went to Las Vegas. We went on one of our crazy Vegas trips. His name was Jim Steen. And I loaned him some money, and he lost a bunch of money. He lost a couple thousand dollars. I loaned him. He couldn't pay me back. So he gave me his car. It was an Alfa Romeo.
So that's your first car.
That was my first car, and that was pretty cool. But what I didn't know is he gave the pink slip to somebody else. So I had the car with no pink slip. Somebody else had the pink slip with no car. So they're both worthless. I can't drive without a pink slip. The pink slip means nothing without the car. So in other words, he paid off two of his debts. He was a crook. He paid off two of his debts and, you know, he welched on both of us. But I had the car. So what I eventually did with the car is I eventually started it. And we lived near a cliff, literally. It was like the woods. It was a little cliff. So I drove the car over the cliff.
Get out of here.
Yeah, it's a true story. And I just let it go down over the cliff. And maybe it's still there now as junk.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Yeah. You didn't leave anything in the glove box.
No, it was cleared out. The car was cleared out. And it was still a pretty nice car, but it was worthless.
Yeah, you can't register. You can't do anything.
I don't think I could even sort it for scrap metal without the pink slip. I don't think they would have took without the pink slip.
Wow. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
If it's out there, though,
it
should be in a museum now.
Yeah.
If it's still out there.
Yeah.
But Eddie, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your morning, afternoon to do this. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Mark. It was a pleasure talking to you. Have a great day and have a great weekend.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of VHS Rewind. Please consider subscribing if you like what we're doing. Also, head over to YouTube and search in VHS Rewind, and you will find our YouTube channel.